Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And hi to my wonderful audience around the world. It's, as always, inspiring to have the opportunity to talk to you and to introduce you to other people, often from around the world, who are interested in the same things you are: truth, values, courage, responsibility. Values too often trampled on in the modern mental health establishment led by biological psychiatry. Now, lately, I've been thinking a lot about, and I've had guests on, talking about psychotherapy, because I'm tuning up, as I've mentioned to you, tuning up to do a certificate program that will eventually be give college credits and maybe other kinds of credits as well, and be a certificate for having taken the empathic therapy course. And not long from now, and much sooner than the empathic therapy training course, coming out in the fall is going to be my similar course on why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. So you can get a certificate you can use. It's information and education you can use as a professional person, but also as someone who wants to use it in your own life and in your own way. And last week I had on Michael Cornwall. Michael has devoted a lot of his life to doing psychotherapy with the most distressed people. Next week, I'm going to have on for a second time in a short time, Kim Oliver, who is just a terrific person and who is holding in charge of the program that I'm co-sponsoring. That's going to be July 26th, 27th, 28th in Raleigh. You can look it up on my website. You can look it up on my frequent alerts, which, by the way, are being widely used, which you can sign up for on my website. And on the 26th, Bob Whitaker and I are going to lead off the conference as a workshop. So if you want to spend time with me and Bob Whitaker, we'll buy yourself. Now, maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 other people. I don't know how many people are going to be in a workshop. If you want to do that, you know, go to my website and look up the William Glasser Institute, the conference co-sponsored by Peter Bregan and the Empathic Therapy Center. Now, Michael Cornwall, I mentioned to you, is coming out with a new whole journal devoted to extreme states of mind and emotion. And he's got a bunch of good folks who've written articles for it, including me. And today, fitting in with Michael's last visit and fitting in with my focus right now, which is so much on psychotherapy, I have on for the second time Michael Guy Thompson. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Peter. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. I'm good. Michael was on, his name may be familiar to you, in October 2nd, 2013. And remember, you can look up on Bregan.com, you can look up all of my radio shows and see who's been on and search for Michael Cornwall or search for me, the shows I've just done by myself. Now, Michael has an article in this forthcoming journal, Humanistic Psychology, which will be available online as a journal that you can purchase. And he's been doing interesting things forever. I was first got to know him when he did a conference back in 2013 on R.D. Lang. I think it was on Staten Island. I got to go there and meet some colleagues who have similar and common shared interest in helping people who are very distressed and figuring out ways to do it. Michael's article talks a lot about friendship as a key. So that's just really, 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 I think, a central feature of anybody who's thinking about psychotherapy is to think about friendship. It may seem a little odd, but I think it's absolutely key. Michael himself worked with R.D. Lang on a previous show. He talked about his experiences with R.D. Lang. They may come up again today. He's a writer. He's a very, very much a speaker around the world. He's a man who's really devoted himself to thinking a lot and doing a lot about how do we deliver services to folks who really need it. Before we're done today, and I'm just about done with my intro, which is kind of going on a little longer than usual. Before we're done today, he's going to talk about a new place. I don't think he'd call it a facility, a new spot in the universe, maybe a house. He's going to tell us about what he hopes to be the nearest program to what R.D. Lang and Lauren Mosier and other great innovators in therapy have been doing in the past. Michael, welcome again to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hi, Peter.
Where would you like to begin? I'm interested in anything you want to talk about, the friendship issues, the experiences you've had with R.D. Lang in the past, maybe most of all, what kind of plans you have in mind for the San Francisco Bay Area for your retreat.
Well, I'd be happy to bring you a bit up to date, Peter, on what's been going on since we last spoke and 2013. As you know, I was organizing a tribute to Lang's legacy on the 25th anniversary of his death, which was the reason we had that conference at Wagner. And a lot of things came from that meeting. We had such an enthusiastic response to it, and a lot of the participants wanted to keep this going. You know, the spirit and the energy that got accessed during that weekend, and we decided to continue with having R.D. Lang in the 21st Century symposia and workshops. We'd done it on the East Coast, so we thought, why not organize a meeting at Esalen Institute in California? And, Lang had been a very frequent visitor there over the years. So in 2015, we had our first five-day workshop at Esalen. And this is now picked up as an annual event. Each year we pick a different theme. It's still a same idea. A lot of us who knew Lang and worked with him host the meeting and give papers. But we have about 50 people that turn up for these each year. In 2015, the theme was what is sanity and what is madness. And last year, 2016, the theme was what is therapeutic? And we're going to have another meeting this year. Unfortunately, Esalen had to close down due to torrential raining and flooding. So meeting this year is at Asilomar Conference Center in Pacific Grove. It's the same idea, five-day workshop, and the theme is what are altered realities. So as you're maybe picking up from these themes, Peter, these are touchstones with themes that were very much on Lange's mind that he wrote about and developed. But the other reason we're having these annual workshops is to bring attention to our efforts to open up a house, as you call it. It is a house. It's we're calling it a retreat center rather than treatment center. And it would be very close to the work that we did in the UK with Kingsley Hall and Portland Road, medication-free, where psychotherapy and group therapy and family therapy would be the therapeutic agent, where people can take as much time as they need, optimally a year or more, to really have time to get to know themselves. And alluding to the paper that you mentioned earlier, establish friendship with the people that they're living with. So that's what I've been doing for the last few years since we talked.
Well, it's so much my belief that human connection is the opposite of madness, that madness is a disconnection. Often brought about by trauma, disappointment, losses, difficulties growing up, early nurturing difficulties. It's all about people relating to people. And I like very much your emphasis that it's going to be a place for people to make friendships, because often folks who have been through or going through very extreme states, they don't have the capacity anymore for friendship. Would you agree with that? They've been so wounded, and they've also their own choices. They become so withdrawn that they don't have anyone they're close to keep them in touch with human reality, human relationship. Does that make sense?
I think that's the nub of the problem, Peter. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think friendships are in some ways a underestimated part of our lives and what makes our lives meaningful. We seem to take friends for granted to some extent, and very often they become very casual. But I've been fascinated with the concept of friendship and what a friend is ever since I read Aristotle's wonderful thoughts about it in his book on ethics. And I'm not sure anybody's really improved on that. But one of the things that that's come to my attention about a friendship is that a friend is a person that you love and that loves you. It's a relationship rooted in reciprocity. It's not a sexual relationship, although in some ways you could say the modern marriage is a friendship with sex. But I think the reason we all need friends is that we need people that we are not in relationships with in a obligatory way, but we're in that relation because we want to be there. And you're right. I think that people that get labeled, say, schizophrenic, have no friends or have very, very wary relationships with friends. And that's the thing that struck me about, living in London at Portland Road, the house that that Lange had set up and Hugh Crawford. We seem to spend all of our time just trying to help people get closer to each other and talk to each other. It's a very, very hard thing to do when you're afraid of people.
One of the dilemmas, I think, in a retreat like that is that, and it's also one of the good things about it, is that all the folks are having trouble with relationship. One of the things that came out that sort of relates in an interesting way to this at your conference is how many of the therapists that surrounded R.D. Lang and perhaps R.D. Lang himself, you know, the relationships were difficult for them. They didn't come easily. And how does that work out in a setting where there's a general difficulty folks are having, yet they're coming together to try to improve their ability to relate? I've never asked that question before of anybody, I don't think.
Well, that is a $64,000 question, I think. Yeah, how in the world do you make a friend, I think, is one way of couching that question. In my psychotherapy practice, one of the most common complaints that my patients tell me is that they have no friends or they're very unsatisfied with the friendships that they have. So this seems to cut right across every conceivable diagnostic category. It's just more extreme. You know, obviously, the more anxious and fearful you are of intimacy, the more difficult it's going to be to make a friend. But I don't think you can contrive it. Some of the online dating services, for example, come up with all kinds of ways to try to get people together, common interest and so forth. I think friendships occur spontaneously. I don't think you can force it. I think that it's just something that has to kind of take a natural course, but you have to have the opportunity. And that means you have to be in a situation where you're spending time with people. So if you're living in a house, say, with 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 other people, you're spending all this time together. The last thing I would want to do is to try to be a matchmaker. You know, let's have exercises or something and get you people, interacting with each other. That becomes artificial so quickly that nobody would enjoy that. So really what you're really doing is just letting time be a significant agent for this. If you spend enough time with people, day in and day out, share meals with them, you're going to basically be putting up with them. But after a while, your own loneliness and your own yearning for connection and intimacy is going to kick in and try to find a way to talk and connect with people. And that's the whole concept of the Langian houses and the one that we're hoping to set up in the Bay Area. And this is why it takes time. You can't come into a home like that for 2 or 3 months and expect something wonderful to happen from that. You have to really not look at the clock and give yourself time to breathe and live there and inhabit the place, and then see what happens. And the first thing you'll notice is the difficulty that people encounter with talking to each other. I mean, before you know it, somebody says something, their feelings get hurt, they withdraw, you know, and they don't want to talk to them again. And that's a dynamic we're all familiar with. A lot of people lose friends over hurt feelings and don't know how to bridge that, how to get beyond it. And that's what we're basically helping people to do. That is the therapy, in effect, of a residential living situation. It's not really formal group therapy. It's just living in a place together. That's the therapy.
Will you be living there? Will there be people who are designated therapists living there? How is all that going to work out, the professional issues and boundaries and stuff like that?
Well, there's been all kinds of different ways of trying to organize such a place. You know, when I was in London working with Lang, at one time there were 8 different houses of this kind that were in operation, each with different therapists and residents, and each with a completely different way of trying to make that work. The system that I've come up with that I think might fit best in an American milieu is to basically have a couple of people that are paid to live in the house, you know, that make sure that there are meals and cleaning and so forth going on. But they're not therapists. They're just people that live there that want to be in that milieu, and no special skill set or training other than they're good at relationships. And then we would have maybe up to 6 residents that may have been in hospitals or may be in danger of being admitted to a hospital for one reason or another. But in addition to that, we would have a couple of spots available for people with no psychiatric history, maybe students, maybe therapist in training, maybe an adventurer. You know, I was one of those people when I lived at Portland Road for 4 years in London. I paid rent like everybody else. I had no special status. I was there because I wanted to both learn about psychosis, and I also wanted to learn about myself. And I thought this would be an amazing way of getting more insight than psychotherapy might be able to give me into some of my basic issues and problems in my relationships with other people. And I have to say it was a powerful experience for me and life-changing. I'm convinced that my living at Portland Road actually cured me of my depression that I'd struggled with since childhood. So we want at least a couple of people that would be living in this house for that reason. They have no particular role. They're there because they feel they might be able to benefit from it and learn something and contribute. So there we're talking about maybe 6, 8, 10 people living in this house. In addition to that, we would have students, graduate students that would be spending time there, volunteering. I wouldn't be living there myself, but I would be spending 1 or 2 evenings a week, you know, participating, getting to know everybody, having dinner, just sharing the space, and of course, helping to supervise the 2 staff people that are actually living there and holding the place together. People would be in psychotherapy with a therapist if they choose to be outside of the house. There might be some family therapy going on if their families live locally. But it would just be a kind of a live and live situation, and trying to simulate as much as we can what any residential household would be like. You know, people just being together and living together and sharing their life together with no special schedule to follow, no special activities that keep you busy from morning to night. You'd have to allow for quite a bit of boredom to set in. Otherwise, you never really get in touch with your own personal despair. So it's a place where you can go and just be yourself as ornery as that self might be, or difficult to put up with other people that are in similar straits, and you know, just trying to get along with each other best we can.
It sounds like there would be no designated therapist.
No, there would be no designated therapist. You're right. I mean, I'm a therapist. I have other colleagues that will be rotating. You know, we want at least three evenings where one of us would be coming there to have discussions. It wouldn't be quite group therapy, but it would be a way of trying to generate some kind of conversation to get going. You know, what's going on in the house? How are you guys doing?
So there would be a significant professional presence then, from what you're saying.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, that's not always the case in these experiments in Great Britain, was it? I mean, sometimes they didn't even have that much of a formal therapeutic presence.
The one thing they all had in common, all of the houses that Lang had set up, was that there was a therapist who had been trained by his organization, who set the house up and was the principal person who was responsible for getting people to move in and live there. That was the only therapist that was involved with the house. And that person might come along every evening or several evenings a week to have a presence there. Apart from that, people are pretty much living on their own. But, you know, that kind of a model doesn't really work, Peter, if everybody living in the house might end up in a mental hospital. You need a balance of people that are in dire straits and people who are not in dire straits, people who, you know, have a life. Maybe they go out some of the day for a job. But basically, this is their home, and they're living there, and they're a part of the place. That, without that balance, before you know it, it becomes a very depressing environment. And that's part of the problem, I think, that some of the so-called Soteria houses have experienced over the years. You know, they just put people together in a house and hope that the milieu will automatically work its magic. But it's not like that. You have to be very careful who the people are living there and be very selective to make sure that you're generating the right kind of live and let live environment. If everybody's too depressed to come out of their room, obviously that's not going to be much of a therapeutic milieu.
Yeah, and Soteria House, I mean, that was actually a therapeutic environment. My understanding was that, you know, Alma Men was supervising it, and she picked people to work there who she thought had, you know, just intuitively or by personality were good therapeutic people. It was a real attempt to make it a peaceful and caring environment.
That's right. In fact, I spent a year at Soteria House in the early 70s as a psych assistant. I was in graduate school before I went to London to work with Lang. And Alma was a brilliant person at selecting staff to live at Soteria House. And they were the key that really made it what it was. And the only problem, I think, with the Soteria model was that people weren't there for very long. They were there more in a crisis situation, and live there for maybe a few weeks or a few months. In London, people live there for a year, 2 years. Like I said, I was there for 4 years, and there were people that lived there 5 or 6 years. So time is a factor in that. And it's hard to predict how much time a given person might want to be there or needs to be there. But the Theria worked wonders in the
folks,
short time.
Folks, you can actually Google Soteria House. I've written some about it in my books, not at great length. But you can Google it. And Lauren Mosier was in the U.S. Public Health Service. He was a psychiatrist. He's gone now. Mm-hmm. And I knew him pretty well. Excuse me. And he actually set up Soteria House as an alternative to a local psychiatric facility and compared people who were randomly sent, I think it was randomly sent, to Soteria House, which was a home, a residential home in a suburb, or randomly sent it to the mental hospital. And this brings us then to another major, major issue, which is in Soteria House, very few of the people received medications. I think on occasion there were experiments with no one getting meds. Maybe you would know more about that, Michael. We're talking with Michael Guy Thompson. You might know more of that. And sometimes in the reports that he made, he did a lot of published research on it. A small percentage were on the medications. And folks did better in general than they did going through the mental hospital system, the acute treatment center.
That's right.
But go ahead, pick up.
You probably know that Lauren knew Lang and visited Kingsley Hall in the 60s.
Yeah.
And that's where he got the idea. And Lauren worked for the NIMH in Washington and was in charge of giving grants to innovative programs doing research into schizophrenia in the U.S. in the 1970s. So he funded Soteria House, and he and Alma Mann designed it. It was definitely a departure from Lang's operation. Because at Kingsley Hall and the other houses, there was absolutely no medication whatsoever. Lauren's project, in order to get the funding, was a research project. And as you say, people were randomly either who had a psychotic break were either sent to Agnew Hospital in San Jose, California, or they would be sent to Soteria House. And the Mental Research Institute in Palo Alto, which Gregory Bateson had founded, conducted the research. And people initially were not medicated at Soteria, but if their condition escalated and they felt that it was becoming untenable, then they would be put on some medication to calm them down a bit, but they still stayed in that milieu rather than a hospital environment. And the outcome studies that they came up with after more than 10 years of this experiment were pretty remarkable. The readmission to hospitals was considerably less from the Soteria group than the Agnew's group. So that was should have been very encouraging to keep funding this kind of experiment. But as you know, for some reason, all the funding pretty much dried up in the 1980s, and money was not available after that for this kind of concept. And that's the situation we have today. And that's one reason why we're not seeking public funding. We're going the private route, seeking donations, and that means that the clients who live there would be paying most of the cost for being able to live there.
Yeah, what happened to Lauren, of course, as I'm sure you know, was pretty dramatic. He was actually so successful in his reform work and so strong in his stands he took that he was removed from being the head of the schizophrenia branch or center, I think it was, at the National Institute of Mental Health. And he spent the last part of his career as a public health officer. It's not like they could just fire him. He was U.S. Public Health Service officer. He had a uniform. And he spent the latter part when I met him. He was down the block from me at the U.S. Naval Medical Center there as a psychiatrist there. And that's when I was in Bethesda. I had been at NIMH myself for 2 years and had been in the U.S. Public Health Service, but just for those 2 years. Lauren was a career officer. And psychiatry continually suppresses, and destroys the psychosocial alternatives that work, especially that work for deeply disturbed people. Thomas Oss once wrote that that schizophrenia was like the sacred symbol for psychiatry, that only psychiatrists could treat so-called schizophrenic people, and only they had the medical background to do it, and so on and so forth. And I think he's very much right about that, to the degree that the last place innovation is ever, ever allowed is in the field of those folks who are really, really deeply disturbed or deeply in alternative realities. And I think that, Michael, I think you're very, very right to support this outside of the establishment, because the establishment simply wrecks, compromises, and or eventually wrecks all these innovations. And it's rejected really good ones going on right now. We, you can Google Open Dialogue. It's from Lapland in Finland. It's a whole city that is operated on the principle of making early intervention in the families where young people are having their first psychotic break, and they practically eradicated long-term chronicity in Lapland. It's getting very little attention here in the U.S. More and more, but not much.
Well, we're not as socially minded as Europeans and New Zealanders. The 80s was a devastating decade for treatment programs in the United States. That's when we decided that it was just too costly to have people in mental hospitals, and we began to close them down. And the next thing you knew, we had street people flooding the major cities of the United States. And I was amazed when this phenomenon was happening. I'd come back to live in the States by then, that nobody put it together at that time. It was this mystery. Where did all these street people come from? It was almost like a blanket cultural amnesia. It was nobody made the connection. Well, they used to be in mental hospitals. Now there's no treatment for them, so they're living on the streets. Now today, we kind of grudgingly come around to acknowledge that, yeah, that is the problem with most of the street people. They've kind of pretty much been abandoned by society. We don't want to spend the money, Peter, I think is what it comes down to. And Soteria and other similar kinds of residential programs do cost money. The longer that you're there, the more money it costs. We want very quick solutions and minimal expenditure. And that's why medication has just completely taken over the treatment of anything that is psychotic or depressive. So our program would be too expensive to be publicly funded. Nobody wants to invest that kind of money in people that are, quote, crazy, because we just have such a visceral repugnance and hatred of people that have lost their minds. We just don't want to know about it. So it doesn't matter that Lauren was successful with Soteria and John Perry with Diabasis and so forth. We just don't want to look at this. And that's the tragedy of American culture right now. And we're seeing the results of it in our healthcare services as they're deteriorating further and further.
Well, I have a more grim view of it than that. I don't think that good services are necessarily or have to be very expensive or even more expensive. Shifting, say, to the model of nutrition, where I become increasingly involved in nutrition in terms of general medical health, not specifically psychiatric. And one of the things that's very, very clear is that if the first approach to heart disease, diabetes, stroke, and a variety, rather almost all diseases practically, were nutritional and the backup was medical, people would be treated much less expensively. And in fact, the professionals like the more expensive treatments. Mental hospitals are very expensive. The state hospitals were not very expensive, but they were just giant lockups mostly.
Mm-hmm.
They'd rather do cardiac surgery and support the Cleveland Clinic or some other great hospital with cardiac surgery, which has a very, very poor outcome, versus nutrition for cardiac disease, which has a very good outcome. So I don't really think it's the money issue. That's the make-believe issue. It's power. It's authority. It's pharmaceutical industries making money, not saving money. The drugging of America is costing us a fortune in injured people, harmed people. A lot of the drugs that Medicare, the states have been paying for costs more than individual psychotherapy on a weekly basis. You know, the Zyprexas and the Risperdals and the Seroquels and the Abilifys are extremely expensive. The average person on psych drugs now who's, you know, on the heavy drugs, which is a lot of folks, is more costly than somebody who's getting good therapy and certainly more costly than somebody who's going to be in your program. So I think it's convenient to bring up, well, you know, we don't want expensive alternatives. I think our professions and our industries love expensive solutions. They don't want more down-to-earth, real, caring, far less expensive alternatives.
If it's not a money issue, then what is it, though? Why is it? Yeah, go ahead, maybe.
So, I mean, that's one reason why some of us and not just myself, want to do these certification programs where you don't doesn't take any training or prior education at all. You're a good person. You've raised your kids. You've retired. You're a young person. You want to try something new. You can be trained as a coach, essentially doing things that a lot of therapists do. Be so much less expensive, and the people would be so much less encumbered. So I don't think it's that people, you know, that we want cheaper alternatives. I think we want alternatives that feed big industry, that feed big psychiatry, that feed big medicine. It's almost the opposite idea of wanting things to be less expensive. The less expensive alternatives do not thrive in the medical and health environment at all. I think it's power, big government, big industry, big medicine. It's all part of a giant complex that is out to provide very expensive alternatives to people.
Okay, so why is it that, for example, the city and county of San Francisco, that's one of the most liberal cities in the country, you know, very generous with health services. As you probably heard, California is actually going to adopt its own single-payer health care system in the state. That's, our country's not going to do that. The city and county gives money for people that are experiencing psychotic breaks, but it's only for very short-term interventions. It's only for a few weeks. It's not anything longer than that, and the reason that they give for that is because it costs too much money to do it any longer than that. It's not cost-effective. So how do we get
what kind of short-term interventions are they doing?
Well, they're basically set up to help people that are ideally being caught with their first break, so that rather than going to a hospital, they can go into a respite center where they will be looked after by non-therapists for a few weeks to get them through this crisis. And then after that, hopefully they'll be stabilized, but there will be no more treatment per se.
First of all, that doesn't sound like a very expensive treatment at all. It'll probably be much less than they're going to a mental hospital, which generates huge costs. The system is fundamentally geared, whether it's from the left or the right or the middle, the system is dominated by psychiatry, medicine, and the psychopharmaceutical company at the top. And the stuff they're going to push is the very expensive alternatives, where there's a lot of power and authority and high-priced therapists and high-priced psychiatrists and so on and so forth. And they'll give out these little things that actually aren't all that expensive but are a terrible threat to the establishment. Because if you can help people with a first break by having them spend 2 weeks in a very expensive place with no professionals, I don't think that's very expensive. If that works, it undermines the system. The good systems like Open Dialogue, they are saving the cities a fortune. Unemployment is down in Lapland. Disability is down in Lapland. All kinds of things are down in Lapland, including misery, human misery, but it hasn't been adopted anywhere else in Finland, because the resistance in Finland from the big money, heavy, top-heavy operations doesn't want to go in that direction. I don't think what you're doing is going to be so inexpensive compared to a brief stay in a mental hospital, isn't it?
Oh, much, much less expensive. There's no comparison. Just wild guess, 10% of what it would cost at the most.
And we know these good interventions prevent, really good interventions earlier on than you're doing, prevent chronicity. The costs are greatly reduced. No, this is a society that's generating money off the backs of its citizens labeled mentally ill, or just ordinary folks taking drugs or giving it to their kids when their problems are issues of psychology and religion and spirituality and employment and friendship and so on. I am surprised at my enthusiasm for converting you here to seeing it in a somewhat different light. But I'm sure you've been exposed to what I'm saying before.
Oh, no, absolutely. Sure, I think that there's a real need for this crisis intervention, and preventing people from becoming chronic mental patients. There's also a need for those so-called chronic sufferers who have not had that opportunity and who've been struggling with these problems for years. live with their families, live with their parents. They have, you know, really no hope and nowhere to go. And those are the people that I'm more concerned about trying to help. You know, what are we going to do about all those people? Yeah.
You know, Michael, to give you another example of how it's not about the cost, we have around the country, you know, these new professional degrees that allow people after 2 years training to be mental health associates or mental health workers, and some of them become degrees that are in the field of counseling, and they have to promise that they won't necessarily, a lot of these groups, it's in the licensure, mm-hmm. they have to promise they're not going to treat severely ill people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, actually,
nobody wants lower cost who's running the system.
Our program is actually off the grid, Peter. We're not calling it a treatment center. We're not treating any illnesses. Ours is a coaching, life coaching kind of approach. Just people wanting to help out because that's where their heart is. I don't know that you can train people to open their hearts to people. Just like we were talking earlier, how do you make a friend? You can't take a course on that. And I think this gets back to a very favorite theme of yours, is the role of love in psychotherapy and in so-called treatment programs. We don't talk about that. You know, we reduce it to some kind of technique or technology or expertise. When really the key to any good therapeutic relationship is the love, you know, that flows in both directions of the participant. That's really what works. And you're right, drug companies aren't remotely interested in that conversation. They're going to shut it down at every opportunity.
No, and neither really are the governments, our states, and our, you know, the higher up you get, by the time you get to the federal government, nobody's interested in anything except power and money and control.
Exactly.
This is the way it's probably always been. You know, whether we had kings or dictators or federal governments and so on. Say more about this interesting and important concept of being off. Let me say something else first. I'm actually going to try, and I am trying, to teach therapeutic approaches that are based on caring and love. Mm-hmm. When my course comes out in the fall on why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs, you see 26 hours of me relating to a small seminar of people. So there's modeling, there's encouragement. So I'm thinking that there are ways even to de-indoctrinate professionals. I'm helping young psychiatrists give up their false notions, you know, and to think more in terms of what their personal gifts are to share with people. So I'm hoping that you can choose to some degree people who are going to be caring therapists. I'm hoping. And that you mm-hmm. certainly can encourage them. I've taught in counseling mm-hmm. schools for decades, and I think I've encouraged a lot of young counselors to be more caring and loving with themselves, their families. I mean, they tell me this happens during the course. So, you know, I think we can model and help people, but it's got to be very direct, and it's got to be about that. And mm-hmm. it's a lot nearer to being to the ministry than to professionalism in mental health. It's a lot nearer to helping people love one another, which is one of the goals of a ministry.
I think you're right. So, I think it is much closer to that, absolutely. And that's no doubt why Lang was so involved in spirituality, because I think there is a connection there between love and helping. And historically, the church had a big role in helping people like this. And now it's been taken over by the so-called mental health industry, that's just turned it into another technology to make money with. That's why I love your work, Peter. I think, you're one of the few people out there that is fighting this fight and bringing attention to it and trying to redress it and to make things better. Yeah. And I really applaud you for that.
Thank you. And I applaud you for what you're doing. I'm just very, very pleased to have you on the show. And tell me, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Do you think that if you're successful, you'll be vulnerable to being declared a mental health facility and closed, basically?
Well, that is the concern. We're trying to avoid that happening. The irony is that this is not treating mental illness. I just published a book last year called The Death of Desire, Existential Study in Sanity and Madness, where my principal argument throughout the book is that we shouldn't be thinking about people with these kinds of issues as mentally ill. That's a completely fabricated concept. We all suffer with our states of mind. Some of us don't do as well as others, and there's reasons for that. But we're not trying to do treating some kind of mental illness. We're just trying to help people that are lost and alienated and having trouble getting along with other people, that are really scared and frightened, have lost their wits, to find a home, where they can try to get that balance back, and that traditionally has been a more spiritual undertaking rather than a psychiatric one. And I think we will probably be accused of surreptitiously treating mental illness. Right. When people find out that people diagnosed schizophrenic actually are living in our houses. But we're doing everything we can to avoid that. So we'll have to see how that works out.
Folks, we're drawing to an end in this really interesting conversation. My guest is Michael Guy Thompson, especially if you put in the middle name Guy. It's easy to find him on the internet and look at the work he's doing and see what his books are and his publications are. And Michael, thank you very much for being on the show, and may God bless your program. I just hope you have great success in what you're doing. Thank you so much, Peter.
So delighted to be on your program.
Bye-bye, folks. I hope you've enjoyed this. We're really delving deeply into what is therapy all about, which is what is life all about. Thank you.